This is the First Time Podcast.
Part reality series.
Part writer's masterclass. It's a podcast about the first time
you publish a book.
I'm Kate Mildenhall.
And I'm Catherine Collett. Welcome to The First Time. Kate, I feel like, you know, we do the intro for the show. It all seems a little bit frivolous at the moment, doesn't it?
It does. Everything seems a bit frivolous in this shitful kind of week.
So the week that we're recording this, we've got protests and riots in America following the murder of George Floyd. Situation in Australia has been pointed out as being different but just as horrifying in some ways. We had a really recent event or an incident with the New South Wales police force and a young Indigenous boy. We obviously live in a country that has a pretty long history of racism. The First Time is not a news show, but one of the things we think we can do is support First Nations people and culture.
So our first thing is that if you are a Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander writer, if you're part of a publishing house that's releasing a new work that you think Australia needs to read, or if you have in mind someone that you'd love us to interview, if you want to get in touch with us in all the ways that you can via Twitter or via our website, please do that and we'll try our best to get those people and those books onto our show.
Another way of supporting, obviously, is to engage with Aboriginal culture. In some ways, it's a minor way, but I think it's also a really powerful one. Kate, you can start. Any recommendations?
I do have some recommendations. So I'm breaking it down into three things, and I'm starting with listening, which I know has been really prevalent as the kind of key thing that white people need to do at the moment. So I'm trying to expand who I listen to. We listened to the end of the, or watched the end of the project last night, and they had an academic, Summer Mae Finlay, I think, on the show. And the hosts were kind of asking, what should we do? What can white people do? And she was saying, you know, we've been saying this for so long in this country. If you're not listening, if you don't know what to do, that's actually kind of willful ignorance. So in that line, I think taking the responsibility of education onto ourselves and following people, listening to people. So on Twitter, some of the people that you could follow are Indigenous X, Amy Maguire, Evelyn Araluen, Celeste Little, Naki Alui, Anita Heiss, Claire G. Coleman, who we've interviewed on the show. We'll put links to all of these people in our show notes, but also you should be seeing them at the moment in your feeds as well. And also we've just retweeted from the First Time, Larissa Berendt listed a bunch of organisations that are news services. So if you're not getting the news you think you should be getting, have a bit of a look outside at other news services. What's your first recommendation, Catherine, so people can stop listening to my
extensive list? I was just offering one follow on Instagram. Senator Briggs, have you heard of, seen?
Okay, yeah.
Senator Briggs, who initially I thought was, in fact, a senator, is not a senator. He's a rapper. and I imagine a lot of people have heard of him through the video that he produced with Tim Minchin not very long ago. Have you seen that video, Kate?
I haven't seen the video. No, I haven't seen the video. But he's also got, I think, a picture book out at the moment.
He does. Nice. Now, the picture book is called Our Home, Our Heartbeat. It's in stores at the moment, and it's celebrating Indigenous achievement. But he had a good post, which felt like one of those things that was just talking directly to me. His Instagram post, I think it was this morning or yesterday, had a picture of him and his book, and the caption was, "You blacked out your tile yesterday. What are you going to do today?"
Yeah.
It's a deeply uncomfortable moment.
But it's so true, huh? It's trying to turn our things into action. And I think that whole thing, because a couple of times I've been like, oh, mate, is this – am I virtue signaling? Is that what I'm doing now when I'm like putting these things up on Twitter or whatever? But you know what? Maybe it's both. And you've got to do it anyway. You've got to amplify those voices anyway. So on other books, go back to Anita Heiss's episode and read. She's got a bunch of new recommendations. We've put a thread on Twitter with all of those. She also recommends the Black Reads Auslit database, which is an incredible database, and we've linked to that as well. Some new ones on my pile this week are Firefront, which is a new poetry collection that's edited by Alison Whittaker, and that's out from UQP. And the other one, which my amazing bookshop recommended to me, is called Homeland Calling, Words from a New Generation of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Voices, which is edited by Ellen Van Nierven. So that's a little collection as well. And it's hard to go past re-recommending Terra Nullius, Claire Coleman's incredible book. And lots of people have been saying on Twitter, like, don't go past fiction as well. Like, it's really important to read all those books, you know, talking up to the white women and, you know, why I'm not talking about race to white people anymore, those books, but also to talk, to read fiction. And Claire was the first ever person we interviewed.
She was.
She was, which is pretty special.
That's all the way back in season one.
All the way back.
The one I had that is my dad gave me ages ago and has been sitting on my bedside table for far too long is Dark Emu by Bruce.
Yes.
Looking forward to that. The other thing we're doing this Saturday night is I'm going to my mum's house for a movie night.
Nice.
And we are finally watching The Australian Dream, which is the story of Adam Goods.
Yes. All of you together?
It'll be me, Carney, mum, my brother and sister-in-law.
So nice.
Should be good.
Nice. Family viewing. My last recommendation was about donating, and we will put these links in the show notes as well. The one I donated to this week was Free Her, a GoFundMe that's a WA organisation that funds bail for Aboriginal women who are incarcerated. There's lots of links on Twitter. The other thing, for people who do use Patreon, and we thank our amazing patrons, I'm a patron of Indigenous X, so that's the Twitter account I mentioned before, and they're a media organisation, so you can do that really easily and support those writers and activists getting messages out as well. Chris Flynn is the author of The Glass Kingdom and A Tiger in Eden, which was shortlisted for the Commonwealth Book Prize. His fiction and non-fiction have appeared in The Age, The Australian, Griffith Review, Meanjin, Australian Book Review, The Saturday Paper, and many other publications. He has conducted interviews for The Paris Review and is a regular presenter at literary festivals across Australia. Chris lives on Phillip Island next to a penguin sanctuary. His latest novel is Mammoth, published by UQP. Chris Flynn, thank you so much for joining us from your little home there in Phillip Island. It's cold there, you said.
It's a bit chilly, but it's a different climate here to Melbourne. So it's the sort of coastal climate. It's completely different. So
Yeah. It's
always about, if it's 2 degrees in Melbourne, it'll be 7 degrees here. And if it's 35 degrees in Melbourne, it'll be 30 here. So it's always just that little bit milder here than it is anywhere else.
I did read somewhere, and I can't remember where it was, that you do have a swim every morning. What, even when it's this cold?
I haven't been swimming at the moment because I do live next to the beach.
Great.
But it's a very public beach.
Okay.
And I usually don't like to wear anything when I swim.
Right. Come on, it's ISO. How is it so public right now though?
People are still allowed to walk along the beach. It's the main beach, and there's children and stuff around. They don't need to see that.
Right. You don't want to frighten anyone.
But there's an abandoned quarry at Cape Woolamai, and an old granite quarry, and the beach there is quite secluded. You've got to clamber over quite a few huge rocks to get there.
Okay.
And so my partner and I will go for a walk there, strip naked, have a swim, stand there in the sun and sit in the rocks and dry off, and then get dressed and come home.
Sounds delightful. So this is clearly part of the writing routine, get you started in the morning.
Especially in the warmer months, I will get up in the morning, which is unusual for me, and walk. It's like an hour walk to get there. So you've got to make a big effort.
Yeah.
So you're entitled to that swim.
Hell yeah.
And you feel amazing afterwards. I mean, your skin's all salty and dry, but it's when you come home, you feel like you've already had a full day.
Yeah, brilliant. If only we all lived like that.
Yes, that's right.
Tell me, we're going to start with this strange new world of releasing a book into a pandemic. I know that Mammoth isn't your first book, but it is the first book you've released into a pandemic. What has it been like, Chris?
Um, I, I've got that Irish sense of expecting disaster. So when a book comes out, I'm just waiting for the sucker punch. Something's bound to go wrong.
And so you were anticipating a pandemic.
I was anticipating something going wrong, something perhaps not quite as dramatic as what did happen. But if there hadn't been a viral outbreak or a nuclear strike or something disastrous, I would have been suspicious.
Right.
So in a way, I was kind of prepared for something to go wrong. And it hasn't really affected the book. We were worried initially that if we went to stage four lockdown, that the distribution center would get locked down and so the stock would be trapped. So we actually, about 3 weeks before the book was released, we decided to send a truck in and rescue some stock just in case.
Oh my goodness. I love that. You broke out the stock.
Shut down. Yeah, we did. We did. I basically spoke to Aviva Tuffield at UQP and I said, what if the stock gets stuck in there? And she was like, oh, you're right. Let's go get some. And so we pulled some out just in case, but it was okay in the end. And then interestingly for me, a lot of publishers have canceled their upcoming releases for the next few months because everyone assumed we were going to be under lockdown, extreme lockdown, until September. So the field has sort of cleared a little bit.
You've got this and I'm getting space to run.
I'm getting an incredible amount of media, and I don't know whether it's because, you know, the book is striking, it's very media friendly, or whether it's because they have nothing else to talk about.
I love that. Just take it as it comes. Best bits so far
of the so book coming far, out? Being on the telly, I was on the ABC on The Mix on Saturday night just past. They did a whole 5-minute segment all about my book, and they had, it's actually a good book for the media to get their teeth into because they can show footage of natural history museums. There's
amazing.
A documentary about mammoth tusk hunters. There's loads of things for them to get their teeth into, and it has made me realize that writing a book that's media friendly is gold when it comes to promotions, because then they need real world hooks to be able to grab onto. Whereas if you're writing a book of pure imagination, then that's a little bit trickier for them to find things to talk about.
Was there anything that you were really looking forward to doing that got cancelled?
Well, I was booked to do 18 different festivals and live events. Yeah. So I was going to be traveling all around the country, and I was so pumped for that because it was small towns, like lovely little small town festivals on the coast, heading up to Byron. I was going to be all over the country. And because it's been 6 years since I've had a book out, I love that part of being a writer. So I was really pumped for that. I just thought, this is going to be great. We're going to meet people and talk about the book to audiences. So that was pretty, a bit of a blow. And I've done digital versions of some of those, and that has been fun in its own way. Although it's interesting watching people in the industry scrabbling to work out technology and, making mistakes. And some of the events are a little bit chaotic, but that's okay.
Yeah. Well, hopefully you get another run at it next year if everything comes back. I mean, that's the scary thing, right?
I think next year I'm probably going to be slammed with festivals next year, because a lot of them are saying they're going to invite this year's guests, the virals, I guess we'll call ourselves, the ones who missed out. We're going to get invited back next year. And then there's going to be a bit of a log jam of festivals too, because some of the festivals just postponed until later in the year and even early next year, in the middle of summer, some of them are going to be on. So it's going to be interesting to see who works out, who's going to where.
Who's going where? Because all the writers want to get to the green rooms and to the bar after the events and see people again. I think most of the writers.
I did the Yarra Valley Writers Festival, which was, they had enough time to reposition themselves as a digital live stream.
It was terrific. I watched it all and it was terrific.
It was great. But the panel I was on, all the writers that I was on with, afterwards we were messaging each other saying, that was so much fun, but we just wanted to continue the conversation.
I know.
And sit down, have a glass of wine, something to eat, and chat for the rest of the afternoon. And we were denied that because all of a sudden someone's like, bye, and you're off
gone.
Screen.
Yeah. Yeah, very strange experience. Chris, let's go back a bit. Did you write when you were a kid at school? Did you want to be a writer?
That's all I ever really did as a kid. was write stories. And I, my parents are functionally illiterate. My father's especially very illiterate, and we had no books in the house growing up at all. So I was a strange, precocious child that they couldn't quite understand how I had sprung from their loins. It was almost as if they'd found me in some glowing orb at the end of a long furrow in a field and adopted me as a human child. I can see that I come from them sometimes, but it's I don't know where I got this creative side from at all. But I was always writing stories as a kid, always interested in libraries, going to libraries. The librarian essentially educated me, showing me what books I should be reading, introducing me to the adult section quite early, and introducing me to history and
Have you ever made contact with that librarian again?
I have gone back occasionally. I don't go back home to Ireland very often. My parents are very elderly, but I do go back occasionally. And I will usually go into the little tiny library and say hello, and they always
remember
me.
Have they got copies of your books?
I don't know if they have. I haven't been back for a while, but it's the last time I went in. It was a bit of a strange feeling seeing this. You know, she was a young woman whenever I was a child, and she's still there. And,
I love that.
And now she's so nice. An older woman, and still telling kids about what books they should be discovering. So that's pretty great. I owe libraries a lot in my life, really.
Did you have words published when you were a kid? Was there a school newspaper or anything like that? Did you get to see your words in print?
My first writing gigs as a child, because my father couldn't write, were writing letters of complaint to power tool companies on his behalf.
Excellent. So there's a collection in that, Chris.
There is. My father had this scam going whereby, because he was unemployed, and so he had these scams going, and he would go to a car boot sale and he would buy an old broken drill, and then he would get me to write a letter to Black & Decker or Bosch Tools or Dremel or whoever it was, saying, your drill's broken and I've only had it 2 years. What are you going to do about it? And then they would say, well, if you fix it, we'll pay for it. And then so he'd take it to his friend. His friend would fix it, charge twice as much as it would normally cost. Dremel would then refund them. They'd split the money. Plus, they'd have a working drill, which they could then sell and make some more money. So
Brilliant.
My role, I was complicit in this crime. And by being the one who would write these polite but snarky letters of complaint to power tool companies, that was my first gig as a kid.
That is brilliant. So tell me, from complaints letters to your first book, A Tiger in Eden, what's the story there? How did that come about?
There's quite a big jump. I was always writing stories in high school. My English teacher was a bit of a bastard, and he's not someone I liked very much. And my creative writing assignments, he would often give me zero for them because he would say that I misinterpreted the title. Because I didn't write what he wanted us to write. My history teacher was much more supportive of my writing than my English teacher. But throughout my 20s and 30s, I was always writing, sending manuscripts off to publishers, not getting anywhere, sending out stories, not getting anywhere.
Encouraging rejections or just flat out no's?
Yes. When I was fairly young, probably about 20, in my early 20s, and I was living in, for my sins, I was living in Newcastle in the north of England, and I sent Virgin at that time, were a publisher in the UK, and they were publishing some pretty edgy stuff, and I sent them a crazy manuscript, and they sent back a very long, handwritten, like 3-page long rejection explaining what was wrong with it and what I should think about doing if I wanted to be published. And that was pretty amazing.
Wow.
And I also got a handwritten rejection from The New Yorker when I was in my mid-20s. I
sent them again. That's one to
frame. I've got it in the drawer.
Love it.
Again, I sent them a short story that was completely inappropriate. This would never have been published. And they sent me back their pretty standard rejection slip in the mail, but it had this beautiful handwriting on it. but it wasn't, and it was basically explaining what was wrong with the story. But the handwriting, it was like a handwriting of a 92-year-old man, and it wasn't even in a straight line. It was all sort of wonky and off to one side and sort of tailed off as he was trying to explain what was wrong with my story. But he said, you know, keep sending us things. So those little things were encouraging, knowing that at least someone was engaging with my work in some way, even though it clearly wasn't the kind of thing that they were publishing.
So when was the first moment of success? Were there stories published before A Tiger in Eden, or was that it, bang, happening?
There weren't many. When I came to Australia in 99 and I discovered that there was a bit more of a viable literary scene here where you could send your story out to magazines, publishers were a bit more approachable, you could go to events, you could meet people. It didn't seem such a closed shop. And I had a short story published in Mianjin when Sophie Cunningham was the editor. But it was a story about a guy sitting on the top of one of the tall buildings in Melbourne. And Melbourne had been flooded, and pterodactyls had somehow returned to Earth, and he was fighting them.
Nice.
But Sophie loved science fiction, and no one ever sent her science fiction. So she published that in Mianjin. And then I had a short story published in the Griffith Review not long after that, about one of those, it was called Panther, and it was about set in Castlemaine, and it was about the mythical rural panther. But I was still writing novels then and sending them out and getting a bit of encouragement from some Australian publishers. But I think people had their eye on me because they thought, well, he's obviously determined enough to keep sending stuff, so maybe eventually he'll hit the jackpot. And I had sent a complicated novel to text, and they liked it, but not enough to sign it. And then I had this other mess of a novel that I had spent years writing, and that was A Tiger in Eden, my first novel, my first published novel. But that was initially written from, I had six different drafts of that. I had written it from the point of view of the character as an older man looking back on his life, and it just didn't work. A few people read it and said, look, it's just not working. And I couldn't work it out. I just didn't know what was wrong with it. And then I was about to go away overseas on holiday. And about 6 weeks prior, I was reading through it. And I saw that at one point, a character said to the protagonist, what did you do in your 20s? And he said, oh, I just bummed around Thailand. And that one paragraph became the novel.
Wow.
I basically thought to myself, well, what did he do in Thailand when he's in his 20s? And I just started writing in his voice, performing it as I walked around the room, because I knew the character so well, because I'd written him as an older man, as a younger man, I knew everything about him. So I was able to do a bit of method acting and get into character. So I literally walked around the room saying what I thought he might say. Then I'd sit down, laugh, and write it down. And I flashed out this 6 week. I knew I had 6 weeks to do it because I was going overseas. I flashed out this stream of consciousness draft in his voice. Thought it was a fun exercise and nothing more. And I submitted it to text just before I went on holiday. And then when I came back, it was just for them to, the editor there, David, to read. I thought he might enjoy looking at it from that perspective. And then when I came back, they said, oh, do you want to come in for Friday night drinks? Which I had done a few times with them. And I went in for Friday night drinks and Michael Hayward sat next to me and he said, so Chris, we'd like to sign your novel.
Ah, oh, the dream.
I didn't know what he was talking about. Because I didn't think that was a novel. I didn't know what he was talking about. And I immediately thought, oh, it's that previous novel that they rejected. They've changed their mind. Oh, my God, I can't believe it. And I said to him, what novel? He said, the one you sent us. Which one? He said, the one you sent us a few weeks ago, set in Thailand. And I was like, that? You want to sign that?
Wow.
Oh, okay. Oh my God. Like, really? Huh. So they were all laughing because I was so confused that they would want to sign that. But it's because that version of the manuscript was so informed by everything that had come before and after that it was kind of just a perfect little microcosm. And it was also limited. It wasn't too ambitious. It wasn't trying to cover too much ground. It was just set over the space of a few weeks in this character's life, it was kind of just a perfect little window. And yeah, there you go. That was my first novel. It was such a shock.
A great story. I want to know whether your process has changed since then. Do you have to do like 20 drafts and 100,000 words in the wrong direction to get to the nugget of brilliance or not? Have you got more efficient?
Right. Yeah, I'm trying to be more efficient. Yeah. I realized this was not a very very productive way of working. My second novel was the previous novel that they had already read, where they basically went back to it and they said, we actually do like that, but it needs to be done completely differently. And that was really good because then I had them giving me lots of feedback on potential direction. I could work directly with the editor who would say, okay, let's think about this character, go away and write me 30,000 words in this character and we'll see where that takes us. Yeah, nice. So I enjoyed that more collaborative process with editorial, and we built the novel over time together. So that was quite a relief, but there was still, you know, hundreds of thousands of words written that never made it to the final version. So still then I felt frustrated. But since then I've tried to be more economical and work out ways where I'm not going to be spending years exploring a direction that will be unnecessary in the end. So, but I think it's an ongoing struggle for me, and probably is for a lot of writers. Sometimes you can't see the story until you've written quite a lot and you think you're working on the story, and then you get to chapter 17, you're 50,000 words in and you're like, oh, wait a minute, this is the beginning, isn't it? Shit, I've just spent 9 months on those first 16 chapters and I'm going to lose them. Ah, damn it, why didn't I see that before? But you just can't see it at the time.
No, you can't. And it's so nice when it's described back to you as that too, that that chapter, I don't know if you're a Bird by Bird fan, but that chapter in Anne Lamott's Bird by Bird where she finally gets to the crux of it, where she's throwing her papers all over the place and screaming at her agent, this is what the book's about. I reread that often when I am feeling like I need to get to the point.
But you must have worry about this too, because I saw on your Instagram yesterday that you had sellotaped together a bunch of pieces of paper to make an extremely long landscape piece of paper that stretched out the length of this huge desk. Yeah. And I thought, tomorrow I'm going to ask her, what's that for? What are you doing?
Well, I think partly that's the timeline, like the kind of 5-year timeline for the period about which I'm writing. But I only want to have a tiny bit as well. But I just realized in the past, when my first book, which was historical fiction, it's so much easier, so much more productive to have that shit down first, to know what the major cultural shifts were or the big events that were happening, because that can really change the direction of the entire story or open it up for you as well. And I was, I'm determined this time. I'm trying to be super efficient this time. I don't think I'm that writer. I think that's part of the problem. I think I have to write 10,000 words, 100,000 words in the wrong direction. Let it not be 100,000. But I am trying to be kind of, more disciplined in my approach. I wasn't going to ask you about all of this because I found in your an article or an interview you did for Kill Your Darlings where you said, I've always felt deeply ambivalent about the process, mainly because most of the time it sounds like a load of horseshit to me. So I was like, well, whether or not it's horseshit, we have to do it. What is, you know, how do you get the words down onto the actual page?
I think when I said that, I was referring more to this, let me be careful what I say here. I don't want to slag off too many people, but this idea of an academic taught approach to being a writer, which is very, very channeled and you must do this. You must follow these rules. That all seems like, that seems bizarre to me that someone can try and break it down into a set of rules or a formula. Like, to me, that bleeds it of life completely. It has to be kind of chaotic for me. And I've tried to learn how to embrace that. And I did with my new book, Mammoth. I did exactly what you're talking about. All this historical research, And I thought, I can't go into this unless I know the background and know what's happening in and around this space, even though I may not use it. But then eventually I allowed myself to be seduced by some of the things that I discovered along the way. And I thought, I'm going to put that in because that's really fun. And the longer I did that, the more I stopped trying to control the narrative and let the narrative go off on its own little journey and take me along for the ride. And I could tell at times, I thought, this is crazy. I'm going off onto a little bizarre rabbit hole here. And an editor is surely going to say, what's this? This is a huge digression. We don't need that. But in actual fact, it became a novel of ideas and digressions that are quite fun, even though they detract from the main narrative. So far, most people seem to be enjoying that. A few, you know, snarky bloggers say, you know, it's so annoying that the narrative keeps getting digressed from.
I think I've seen the premise for Mammoth described variously as wacky, silly, clever, and hot. So normally we don't go into a deep discussion of the book on the podcast, but I do need you to give us the premise for those listeners who are listening and going, what is this strange book? Tell us what the premise is.
It is a bizarre one. It's set in 2007 at a natural history auction in New York. It's the night before the auction, and all of the lots that are up for sale are fossils of dinosaurs, megafauna, other bizarre ephemera. And this was a real thing that happened. It happens every year. And so there was a skull of the tusk of a mammoth, the skull of a Tyrannosaurus, prehistoric penguin, the severed hand of an Egyptian mummy, shark's teeth, all sorts of things. And the premise behind the novel is they're all just talking to each other the night before the auction, and they're explaining how they died initially, when they were dug up, who dug them up, why, and what's been happening to them since, and basically how they came to wind up on sale at an auction. And so it jumps back through to different periods in time as each of the fossils explains their life and death.
So my puny little 5-year timeline from 1930 to 1935 seems just to pale in comparison to whatever you used to organize your research and your thinking and the entire book. How did you collect the stuff together, and did you do it before you started writing the voices or while you were doing it?
No, I was actually quite frightened of the story, and I realized that there was going to have to be an awful lot of research. And so the book primarily concentrates on the end of the Ice Age and then jumps forward to the beginning of the 19th century. So it primarily takes place between 1800 and 1804. So I did try to limit it. I realized otherwise you've got an infinite book that's going to, because you could go into 1805, 1806, and you'll find some amazing thing that happened that year.
Yeah.
And you'll want to talk about it. And then your book will end up being 10,000 pages long, or you'll be working on this series for the rest of your life.
And you can also go anywhere with any of the pieces of any of the bodies of these fossilized, as right. becomes apparent.
Completely.
Okay, so you had to work out some limiting factors.
Yes, and I limited myself to certain years, and then I would exhaust the research before I wrote anything at all. So for the first few years, I didn't actually write anything. I was just making notes, and the whole time I was concerned whether or not I was going to be able to find the voices to tell the story. It was almost like doing research for a huge nonfiction book. But I thought, I can't write a nonfiction book. There's no way I can do that. So I was quite trepidatious when it came to writing it. And I wanted to be fully informed on everything before I did sit down to write. Occasionally during the writing, I would come up against something that I didn't expect, and I would stop immediately and say, wait a minute, they're in a bourbon distillery in Kentucky. What do I know about bourbon distilleries? Nothing. Okay, it stops now, and I'm going to go and spend a month reading about bourbon distilleries and how bourbon was started, because I don't want to even have them there in that scene unless I am fully conversant with that world.
Forgive me getting down to the nitty-gritty. So when you go off then and do that research and reading on the distillery, are you taking handwritten notes of just the interesting thing? Are you kind of just immersing yourself in a bunch of reading images, whatever, and then writing down the important things. Like, what does it look like, that research?
I don't handwrite anything. I do everything on the computer, but I will basically have, because I used a combination of internet resources and libraries and out of print, obscure university press books, where I would research something as far as I possibly could on the internet. But even though it's the sum of all human knowledge, sometimes you just come against, it just peters out, or it starts to repeat itself.
Yeah.
And it'll be referencing source documents. And so I would go then and order these out of print books and wait for them to arrive and then read those. And often they were very much more useful, but I would just make notes. I guess I would use, I'm not scared of writing on books. So I would circle passages, and I tried to use pencil when I remembered, circle passages, mark things, underline them, and then I would go through that and type it all up on the computer and create some sort of notes for myself so I knew what I was going to use and what I wasn't going to use. I mean, in some cases, because there's a lot of actual historical characters in the book, I found that they had written things at the time, so I was able to put words in their mouths that were words that they actually said, and that was super useful.
Had you already pitched the concept to a publisher, and or were you getting any feedback from people when you said, you know, I've got this great idea, I'm going to write a book from the perspective of a mammoth? Like, what were people saying to you?
I'm totally secretive when I'm writing. I don't let anyone read what I'm doing. Mainly because I have a surfeit of ideas, and those ideas don't always pan out. I'm aware that probably 10% of my ideas are worthy and the rest are just nonsense. And I don't want to tell people, oh, I'm working on this, because chances are, you know, 6 months from now, I'll be like, oh, I'm not going to work on that any longer because that's a disaster.
Yeah.
So no one reads it. No one gives me feedback whilst I'm doing it. I certainly hadn't pitched the idea to a publisher. And when it came time to shop that manuscript around, I thought, well, they're just going to say, what on earth is this nonsense? But it surprised me because pretty much all of the publishers in Australia wanted to read it. And I wonder if that's because they get sent a lot of very similar stuff all the time. And anything that's different has an appeal, has an automatic appeal. Mm. And they wanted to at least investigate it and see if it's any good. A lot of the reviews that I'm seeing now, people are saying, I was so dubious about this, so skeptical. It just seemed like a stupid idea. But as soon as I started reading it, I thought, oh, I get it. This is actually fun. This is entertaining. So I was aware that there's that bit of a hurdle to overcome. Yeah. To their credit, my publisher, UQP, Aviva, was instantly enthusiastic, instantly, and they have been ever since. So I actually can't quite believe that I've managed to. It feels like I've got one under the radar, but it's finding an audience, so.
It's certainly not
publishing.
Certainly not under the radar now. And I have to ask, I picked up your book for a number of reasons, but to be really honest, the biggest of those was that Elizabeth Gilbert puffed it and posted about it on her Instagram to her 981,000 followers. She said, I've got it here. She said, brilliant, hilarious, and curiously moving. And I was like, hang on a second. And then I, you know, like, who? Australian author Chris Flynn? And so I did my social media sleuthing. And then I was like, oh my God, you are the person that she was staying with in Melbourne when she was here in Australia. And my mind was blown. So, Chris Flynn, please tell me the story of how you know Liz Gilbert, who is, you know, my hero.
Right. Liz Gilbert is one of the most amazing creatures that lives on the planet. She is everything that you might imagine her to be and so much more. Liz is vastly intelligent, one of the funniest people I've ever met. And so raucous and full of life. She's a joy to have in your life. Now, how did I meet her? My publicist, Brendan, had been her publicist years ago at Bloomsbury. And they had, and he's very similar in terms of his energy and enthusiasm. So they had got on very well and they'd stayed in touch. And he was also the publicist for Liz's recently departed partner, Raya, whenever she wrote a book. So they were best buddies. And I met Liz very briefly at an event in Melbourne. And someone, when the Tiger in Eden came out, I think someone from the Daily Telegraph said that I was a cross between Irvine Welsh and Elizabeth Gilbert. And I thought that was great.
Description.
I thought that was great. So when she came to Australia, she was doing a bunch of talks, business lunches for women. And she was at a bit of a loose end. And I said, why don't you come and stay with us on the island? So she did. And it was like having this housemate for a week who is the best temporary housemate you could possibly have. You get up in the morning and she's standing in the kitchen making avocado on toast, and she'll say something really funny. And so it was, and we went swimming together. It was a very strange, beautiful few days. And it was just before COVID really hit.
Yeah, because so, that kind of just came in at the end of her tour.
Yeah, and so she actually went home a little bit early because she got a little bit concerned that she might get stuck. It would have been funny if she'd been stuck here and staying in my house for months and months.
It would have been delightful. I actually felt like I almost needed, because I'm a recent convert to Big Magic and thus since then have kind of like just inhaled her. Uh-huh. And listeners on the podcast will know that I, recommend something that she said on Instagram in every single episode. But I was trying to get a grasp on both of your creative kind of processes as much as I could understand about yours as I was preparing for this interview. And I almost had to kind of get out my whiteboard markers on the whiteboard and try and draw a line and go, well, hang on, where do these two kind of intersect? So tell me about what inspires you in Liz's kind of approach to writing and creativity.
We're actually very similar. And basically, I identify very strongly with the idea that Liz talks about in podcasts and in Big Magic, which I just read again last week, this idea of not treating your creativity like it's your enemy, not treating it like it's something that has to destroy you, that you have to be miserable, otherwise you're not an artist. I do not subscribe to that theory in any way, shape, or form. To me, art has always been something that is enjoyable, that that makes me feel like a human being. And I've never felt depressed about my work or felt that it was a punishment to have to work. I really believe in intelligence and creativity and empathy and joy. And if you're not enjoying the work, then I don't know why you're doing it. I've had plenty of jobs in the real world in my life. And if I hate the job, I'll leave. Mm. So why would you be a writer if you hate it so much? Why would you force yourself to be miserable? And I think people have this old romantic idea, and she talks about that, of the artist has to be tortured. Otherwise, you're not creating great art. And I don't believe that at all. So I love the fact that her work has a joy to it. And that she lives the way she writes. And she can deal with very difficult traumatic issues, but she deals with them in a very upbeat and positive way. And that's the way I've always lived. So when I read Big Magic for the first time, I thought, oh, this is exactly the way I've been doing things anyway. So this is great. What a confirmation of... I felt like a weirdo because I was a happy artist.
Yeah, see, that's nice, because it certainly wasn't a confirmation for me. It was a wake-up call, and I am working towards taking it more lightly. You know, like I was like, yes, wow, it could be this way. Who knew that you didn't have to be a tortured artist? How brilliant. So I'm kind of recent convert, but as in all recent converts, I am rather gung-ho about her and it as well.
And what do you make of the idea of creativity as existing outside of you, as ideas are out there, and you're not a genius. None of us are geniuses. The ideas themselves are brilliant, but they might land on you because you're the one who is right for the idea at that time. I love that, and it felt very strong for me with Mammoth, because I was years researching this, and it was almost as if I was aware of this huge creature standing over my shoulder, observing me. And occasionally I would look back and say, how am I doing? And they would just nod, yep, keep going, yep, I'll wait for you. And once I sat down, I didn't sit down consciously to start writing the book. I had done all this research, and I could feel that the beginning of the writing process was approaching, but I didn't know when it was going to happen. And I wasn't able to say, okay, Monday, 1st of August, 9 a.m., I'm going to start writing The Voice. That doesn't work. It basically happened completely out of the blue, where on a Wednesday afternoon at 4 o'clock, just before dinner, I was sitting at my computer, and suddenly I could hear The Voice. It was as if this big mammoth just started speaking to me and said, okay, now it's time to begin. And I have accepted you as the vessel for this, and here we go. And the first 5 pages of the book I wrote that day, and we hardly edited a word. And when I sat back and looked at them, I thought, look at that. There's that, this sort of cynical, wise old voice there. That seemed to just appear. Okay, well, I'm going to sit down tomorrow and see where it goes from here. And then so the book actually then was a joy to write. It was, because I felt like I was almost a witness to its writing. And it was flowing through me, and I didn't know where it was coming from. And here was these voices appearing, and it was making me laugh as I was doing it.
And you can feel
and
that.
I think it's because, right, totally feel
you
it.
You feel that as a reader as well when you're reading right. Mammoth. Do you miss him? Do you miss the mammoth?
Yeah, I guess I do. Radio National asked me to record a 7-minute radio play for them. It hasn't been aired yet. And they wanted me to write it as if I was sitting on the cliffs here on the island, and that I received an email from the mammoth. Nice. And I was a bit dubious about it. But when I started doing it, once it came to writing in the mammoth's voice in that piece where he was sending me the email, all of a sudden, there he was, right there, immediately present. And that was a bit of a shock to me. I thought, he's still there. It's sort of ironic that the book has this notion of fossils still having a personality after they die, and that personality lasts forever, because it's kind of how it feels to me. I probably could, if someone begged me to, sit down and continue the story.
Well, you've got a lot of room to move there. Like there's got to be like an entire series, right? Ready to come out.
I stuck him in the ground at one point in the book because I thought I need to bury him again, because otherwise this is going to go on forever.
And so it could. I want to ask you, I knew I'd run out of time, but I'm going to get in a couple more questions. You've been a literary critic for many years. Now, to get a sense of your tastes, I went back through the archives. What an experience that was. So I went back through Australian Book Review, and I found a whole lot of reviews in there, Chris.
Oh, giddy.
May I read to you from one? We can decide to take this out if you don't want it in there. I'll read to you. Notwithstanding, The Dry will doubtless be a bestseller. There is so much marketing hoopla surrounding the overseas rights sales that it will no doubt be critic-proof. While it is always heartening that Australian writing be recognised beyond these shores, it is worrying that such bland fiction should fly the local flag. Now, Chris, Australia's got a relatively small book industry in the scheme of things, and mostly we all get about by being rather lovely to each other, not obviously the critics, but then critics don't always turn around and write books. So how do you feel about publishing into a little world in which you have been both critic and author?
I'll be honest, being a critic in Australia has hurt me a little bit.
Yep.
It has damaged my chances a little bit. I know this for a fact. I'm talking to various publishers. You're right. It is a small world. Everyone's very sensitive. But I'm a terrible liar. I can't just pretend to love something that I don't like. And so they keep asking me to do reviews, and I'm like, oh, okay, but are you sure? Okay. And then if I don't like it, I'll just say that I don't like it. And I know that's a bit anathema to a small publishing scene where there's a bit of a tendency for everyone to sort of grin and pat each other in the back and say, yeah, yeah, we're all great. But I don't think it's very healthy. I think it's good to be aware that we all have limitations and that not everything we do is brilliant. There's a weird patriotism that goes on, I find, in Australian literature. It's almost a right-wing thing that's been adopted by the sort of literary left, which is Australian writing is amazing. We don't want to hear anything else other than that. And if you dare say that something is not amazing, then you are a traitor to the flag. And I mean, I am an Australian. I got my Australian citizenship in 2007. But I think the fact that I'm clearly still Irish as well sits a bit uncomfortably with some people. And I've been asked, you know, are you Australian? Are you Irish? When are you going to assimilate and toe the line? And when my second book came out, someone asked me at an event, what gives you the right to write about Australia?
Wow.
So I think you're sort of damned if you do and damned if you don't. But I clearly, as a bit of an outsider to all this, who has been, you know, partially assimilated, I think I can bring a little bit of skepticism to a debate that has a tendency to be very self-congratulatory.
Given that you have got that perspective as a critic, how does it mean that you approach reviews of your own work, like knowing that some of us are like, oh my gosh, don't look at Goodreads, or also scanning the papers, like pulling out the line in a positive review, like the one line that comes out negative? What's your approach to reading them?
I pretty much have the skin of a rhinoceros when it comes to reviews. I feel nothing whenever I see a review of my work. And I know that's a bit unusual for most writers who are nervously opening the article to see what the review is. I don't feel much at all. I enjoy seeing what people find to like about the book, but I also kind of enjoy when someone doesn't like it, exploring why they don't like it. And I've been sort of fascinated to see any negative reviews, which are usually on Goodreads, of Mammoth. And I'm fascinated by what people find about it to not like. Reviews often say more about the reviewer than the book itself. And that's interesting too. When A Tiger in Eden came out, there was an appalling review of it on Goodreads. The guy reviewing it just went on and on about the sex, and he really didn't like it. And I thought, what's this guy's problem? And then I looked him up, and he had been a Jesuit priest who was defrocked for you know what.
So. Oh, wow. People in glass houses should not write Goodreads reviews.
Yeah, that's right.
Chris, part of me having that enormous timeline, et cetera, out yesterday is because I've set myself a very clear deadline to get a bunch of words done before my next book comes out, because I know that that period in which your book comes out is kind of not only busy, but the crazy highs and all the rest of it of what that entails. Are you getting any writing done at the moment?
I'm trying to, because my publisher, Aviva, emailed me the other day and she said, I know you're in the middle of this media storm and probably don't want to think about this, but I need to pencil something in for 2021, 2022. So what do you want to put in there? And I'm under contract for a book of short stories, which were already done when they signed them. Although I want to completely, there's no way I'm releasing them the way they currently are. I want to start again with those. But I don't know if releasing a book of short stories is the best idea after a novel. So I am working on another novel. I've been working on it for about a year, and it's been on hold. And I keep staring at it, thinking I need to find time to get back to that. And funnily enough, this morning I started writing it again, and now I have foolishly agreed to a deadline to hand in a manuscript in the middle of next year. So I am planning out all of my time for the next few months, and after I speak to you, I have to get a little bit done this afternoon, because otherwise I'll run out of time. And I now have the beauty of knowing that this next book I'm writing will be published. And I have a very fixed timeline for that, which is the first time I've ever really had that, which is actually influencing my process, because I'm now thinking, well, I don't have the luxury of writing 200,000 words off on a tangent. I need to be more focused. I need to make sure that what I'm doing is worthwhile. So it's all a lot more structured this time, but it's still loads of fun because of the subject matter that I've chosen, and the and I've fortunately been researching for the last year, so I've got a lot of information in my backpack that I can pull out and help myself with along the way. And I'm yet again doing it in a completely different way to the other books, so making it difficult for myself probably, but. You never know how you're going to write a book.
You don't, but it's so good to hear. I feel like I should book in a catch up to see how this goes in the next 3 months so I can steal all your process ideas. Before I let you go, what advice would you give other novelists who are navigating perhaps their first release or any kind of release at this given point in the history of the world?
Well, I would say if you have a book that's coming out, then you must remember that you're one of a very select group of people. You did it. That's the thing that you did. And anytime I do literary festivals and there's a debut author on stage, I always make a big deal of them and say, you know, well done. Like, you actually did it. You know how many people around the world want to do that and never get around to it? It never works for them. And you're one of a very select few. So well done. You're now part of a very unique club. There's 62,000 books published every year in Australia. Very few of them sell. That is why I'm raising the point. So people need to enter it with a little bit of a realistic attitude. Of those 62,000, only 12 books sell more than 100,000 copies, right? And those are probably celebrity cookbooks, celebrity memoirs. You might get the odd fiction title, maybe a Jane Harper or Trent Dalton might be in there. Slightly better news is 300 of them, 300 of the 62,000 sell more than 5,000 copies.
Yes.
Which is kind of what you need to break even pretty much. But that means that for 99.5% of people who have a book published, you're not going to make any money. That's just, and everyone thinks, you tell people that statistic and it's like Jim Carrey, you know, he's like, so you're saying there's a chance I'll make money. They see themselves as the 0.5% who are going to hit it rich, but statistically you're not going to. But as long as you know that and you're realistic about it, it's an amazing discipline to be part of. I would always encourage people to channel their imagination and to use the resources they have at hand. And just because everyone tells you, write what you know, which is such a nebulous piece of advice. Write what you know doesn't necessarily mean write about you. If you're writing books, you're probably a hugely intelligent, you know, person who's lived quite a life. So think about that. And maybe what you know is, you know, a lot about French history from, you know, 1800 to 1860. So enjoy diving into something that's not necessarily you and exploring that, and you'll find yourself in there somewhere. But you don't necessarily just have to, you know, turn inward all the time as an author. Just have enough confidence to know that you know what you're doing. You're an artist, you're a professional. Explore the world.
Brilliant advice. Can you recommend us a debut novel anytime, any place?
Michelle Faber, Under the Skin, a seemingly innocuous story, fairly short, about a woman who is picking up hitchhikers in Scotland in her van, and she has needles installed under the passenger seat. She injects them, knocks them out, male hitchhikers, takes them to this farm where they're fattened up and then harvested for their meat, which sounds bonkers, but the book is all about, there's a massive twist to all this as well that you just do not see coming. But the book is about farming practices and the intersection between humans and animals and it plays with that theme that I kind of love and have used a little bit in Mammoth, which is humans need to see themselves as part of the animal kingdom rather than separate from it. Because as soon as we separate ourselves from the animal kingdom, we essentially hurt ourselves, because we establish ourselves as lords over the world, and that has never really worked out very well for us. So I worked at the RSPCA for 5 years, and I'm very pro-animal because I consider us to be animals.
It's going straight on my reading list. Thank you so much for speaking to us, Chris.
What a pleasure. What a pleasure anytime. Well, I probably won't do it again though, will I? This will be the only time.
You can find the show notes for this episode on our website, thefirsttimepodcast.com. If you're feeling so inclined, we would love for you to leave us a review wherever you listen. This helps other people find us.
Get in touch with us via the contact page on our website, or connect with the entire First Time gang on Twitter or Instagram at The First Time Pod. And don't forget, you can support us via Patreon. Go to patreon.com/thefirsttimepodcast. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to The First Time Podcast. We recorded this episode at Kathleen Syme Library on the traditional lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation. The First Time Podcast is produced by Phoebe 80 and supported by Writers Victoria, the ACT Writers Centre, and our wonderful patrons.